From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet British writer Beryl Bainbridge. Her writing methods are as Victorian as her novels. She'll tell us about her favorite topics for historical fiction: obsession, death, and human folly. Five of her books have been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Also, we meet one of America's most innovative product designers, David Kelly. He designed Apple's first mouse, Kodak's digital camera, and those form-fitting Nike sunglasses. Kelly teaches at Stanford and heads his own product design firm. And Jeff Numberg considers the changing linguistic map. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Members of the Palestinian National Council have voted to revoke clauses in their charter calling for the destruction of Israel. In an historic speech in Gaza today, President Clinton praised the council for its action and urged Palestinians and Israelis to move forward now with the peace process. Steve McNally reports.
The president told the 1,000 council members in Gaza that they had done a good thing by raising their hands to confirm their official annulment of anti-Israel clauses in their founding charter. The gesture, he told them, will touch the people of Israel. "You are turning the page on the past," he said. "You've reaffirmed that you intend to share this piece of land with your neighbors without war forever." Mr. Clinton then included Israel in his remarks. He told the sides that they've now got to define the peace between them, not to make it a grudging, mean-spirited peace, but one that is generous and open. "You must judge yourself as you judge each other," he told them. "See their children as you see your own." "There's been enough gnashing of teeth," he said. "It's time to move forward in peace together." Mr. Clinton said he expected there would be more breakdowns on the road to peace, but he called on the two sides to persevere to find the needed breakthroughs. For NPR News, this is Steve McNally in Jerusalem.
The president said today he's seeking what he called a reasonable compromise on the impeachment issue, and he criticized congressional Republicans for calling for his resignation while he's overseas. A White House spokesman said the calls for Mr. Clinton to step down from House Judiciary Committee Chairman Henry Hyde and others rewrite the book on partisanship. Mr. Clinton again today indicated that he would accept a censure from Congress. Progress is being reported in talks between North Korea and the United States over access to a suspected nuclear weapons site. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Seoul.
South Korean news reports, quoting sources in Washington, say North Korea has given up its demand for cash in exchange for inspections of a suspicious underground site. U.S. officials fear the site could be used to revive Pyongyang's nuclear arms program. Pyongyang had asked for $300 million in compensation for access. The U.S. rejected the deal, demanding unconditional inspection. The Seoul reports also quote sources saying that the U.S. has dropped its earlier tough stand that there would be no additional aid forthcoming for North Korea. Washington and Pyongyang just completed 6 days of talks aimed at ending the dispute. The State Department has said little about the negotiations other than gaps remain, but the two sides agreed to meet again. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Seoul.
Yugoslav army troops have reportedly killed at least 30 armed ethnic Albanians and wounded a dozen others today in border clashes in Kosovo. It was the highest casualty toll since an informal truce in October halted the fighting in the separatist province. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 40 points, the Nasdaq down 24. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the impeachment hearings in Washington, coupled with more earnings warnings from some big companies, are hobbling Wall Street at the start of a new trading week. NPR's Jack Speer has the latest.
Despite the news that manufacturers saw their third quarter profits rise to a seasonally adjusted $60.4 billion, a substantial increase from the $51 billion they took in during the second 3 months of the year, Wall Street has begun the week on a down note. Concerns about the possible impact of the impeachment proceedings against President Clinton and more earnings worries sent blue chips lower today. Toymaker Mattel warned analysts to brace for lower earnings at the same time it was announcing a deal to buy the Learning Company for $3.8 billion in stock. Shares in U.S. satellite broadcasting rose today after it was announced Hughes Electronics has agreed to buy the company for $1.3 billion, and Quest Communications stock is higher. That was on news Microsoft has agreed to invest $200 million in the company. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
RJR Nabisco says it is taking the necessary steps to stay competitive following the recent tobacco settlement. The company says it will take a restructuring charge of $335 million, which includes costs for eliminating 1,300 jobs. With petroleum prices scraping the bottom of the barrel, Royal Dutch Shell says it will sell 40% of its chemical business as part of a sweeping restructuring effort. The Anglo-Dutch oil giant also says it will take a $4.5 billion restructuring charge in the fourth quarter. The country's largest discount brokerage, Charles Schwab, has announced it's entering the Canadian market by buying a small Toronto firm, Priority Brokerage Incorporated. The company has about $120 million in customer accounts. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Beryl Bainbridge's life is in some ways as Victorian as her historical novels. Her Victorian townhouse in London is overflowing with period furniture, bric-a-brac, and old photos. She currently collects early examples of wedding photography. Bainbridge shuts herself up in her home for 5 months each year to write. She's survived this ordeal to produce 16 books. 5 of them have been shortlisted for Britain's prestigious Booker Prize, including her most recent novel, Master Georgie. Master Georgie is the third in a trilogy of novels that dissect grand examples of human folly in Victorian times. The Birthday Boys was about Captain Scott's ill-fated expedition to the Antarctic. Every Man for Himself is a mystery set on the Titanic. And Master Georgie follows the trail of an enigmatic physician and amateur photographer whose destiny unfolds on the battlefields of the Crimean War. I asked Beryl Bainbridge to set the scene for us before reading from her new novel.
This bit that I'm going to read is in the voice of Myrtle, who's a 12-year-old orphan girl who has been part of this household, of the Hardy household, in a place called Liverpool. And the master of the house has been found dead and he's been brought home. It's been covered up how he died. He died actually in a brothel, but he's been brought home to look as if he'd just had a heart attack. And he's lying on the bed and the son of the house, Master Georgie, is taking a photograph of him. The old-time photographs, it's obviously, it's 1854, so it takes a long time to set the photograph up. And Myrtle is told to stand beside him. And she, by the way, is obsessively in love. Well, she's only 12, so she's not in love, but she obsessively loves Master Georgie. And so Master Georgie tells her to stand there and pose and to say she's saying goodbye to this father, not her father, Georgie's father. I was saying goodbye to a stranger because the figure on the bed no longer resembled Mr. Hardy. His mouth was a thin, grim line, and there were hairs crinkling out from the nostrils of his mottled nose. I could smell something pungent, a combination of iodine and honeysuckle, and I wrinkled my own. "Stop that," Master Georgie ordered. "Stand stock still. Don't blink." I fixed my gaze on the dead man and told myself God would strike me blind if my eyelids quivered. So intense was my concentration, it was only Master Georgie who breathed in that sun-dappled room. Outside, the birds continued to twitter. All my life, I thought, I will stand at your side. And then I did blink, for the grandness of such a notion welled up tears in my eyes.
Thank you, Beryl Bainbridge, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Why do you write historical novels? Is there something about the historical setting that frees your imagination or gives you a framework to work in?
No, it's not so much that. I wrote 12 other books before that, all about... You see, I've never written fiction until recently. I never wanted to write fiction. That wasn't the point. I've only ever written about my own background, childhood, but stuck it into a plot. And if you do that, after a bit, you use everything up. I mean, I'd used up all about my mother, my father, my brother, myself, Liverpool, all that. I simply didn't have anything else to write about, so I suddenly thought, well, I'll have to go back to history. So that's why that's the only reason I started to do these historical ones, which I don't actually call... Actually, I mean, obviously they are in a historical context, but I think I'd still write... I mean, in Captain Scott going to the Antarctic, I sort of based him a bit on my father, who admittedly couldn't stand the cold, but it's that sort of thing, you know. I mean, I still use people I know... Or they're all dead now, but people that I knew as a child. But I think with most writers, once you get quite well known and once you're doing well, for one thing, you don't meet any normal people anymore. I don't meet anybody that's normal. I just meet other writers, you know. So you can't base anything on people you meet. You have to use the past all the time, so you might as well use something like the Crimean War in which to put your ideas about life.
What's your research method? Just read everything, or you
read,
make notes?
I just read and read. Mm-hmm. I don't go anywhere. I was taken, a television company took me to the Crimea during the last one, but normally I just read and read and read and read, and then it takes a long time because I'm not terribly educated, so it takes me a long time to actually understand what I'm reading. You know, I mean, particularly with the Crimea, I can't tell you how difficult it was. All these damn regiments, they've all got different names. They're awful. They're a battalion one minute and a regiment the next. And they're appalling. That sort of thing. Just have to go over and over and check it. Because I think if you're going to, even if it's fictional, if you're going to base it on an actual happening, you have to be accurate. The historical bit has to be accurate.
I think a lot of historical fiction is all about how heroic people were, and that's certainly not the tack that you take in your books. When you research, what jumps out at you or what impresses you? What are you searching for?
Well, for instance, doing the Crimea. How was I going to start it? I couldn't think. My idea is it's terribly important. You have to have a plot. It's no good just writing something wishy-washy. It's got to have a storyline, a narrative. So I went along to the London Library, and I looked up the Times newspaper for 1846. And I don't look inside the newspaper. I look at the adverts, or little bits, not the adverts. They're sort of little... It's court case things, and it said, Oxford Don found dead in house of ill repute. And so I suddenly thought, that's it. His son will be passing by and will find his father dead inside this brothel. And then I read a bit more, not out of the newspaper, but about the time, those days. And, of course, if you were an Oxford Don, you couldn't be married. So you couldn't really have a son unless he was illegitimate. So I had to abandon that. So I got hooked on the idea that this first scene must be about this man dead in bed in this brothel. And once you get your first bit going, it leads to... Then how was he going to... how were they going to get the body back? And then again you draw on things in your own life. I mean, when I was a child, there was the Punch and Judy man, and I remember the van. So he put him in the Punch and Judy man. Then I'd read lots about photography. So, yes, we'd take a photograph of him. So why was Myrtle so anxious to do whatever Georgie said? Well, she must be in love with him. So it grew from that. You know, it grew one step led to the other in a way. That's really, I think, how the steps go.
You reportedly have a pretty drastic writing method. It sounds a bit like total immersion. What do you do to get a book out?
Yes. Well, I pretend I've halfway through. I'm doing the same now at the moment, and I haven't started. And it's got to be finished by March, April. And I dither. Well, perhaps tomorrow. So let's pretend I start tomorrow. So I would get up at about 9 o'clock. And if I've got the first line, it'll take me 3 or 4 weeks once I get started to get the first paragraph, to actually get the first paragraph. And I'll rewrite and rewrite and rewrite that. And then once that gets going, when I get 12 pages, I will then work, let's say, I work, say, from 9 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Then I'll have a nap on the sofa. Then I'll start work at 6. Then I'll break at 10 o'clock in the evening to watch the news. Then I'll have a fried egg. Then I'll work from 11 till 3. And then I'll get an alarm call for 6 o'clock the next morning. And I'll do that round the clock.
For how long? Four,
3 or 4 months. You can't do it more. You'd be dead if you did it for longer, but for that amount of time.
I read somewhere that around the 9th week you always get ill because you smoke day and night while you're writing.
Yes, yes. Well, then I get ill and then I recover a bit. Well, when I say I feel ill, I don't get ill. I just feel terribly ill, but I don't get ill. Well, I haven't so far. Sometimes I get teeth abscesses and things, but you swallow a bit of aspirin and you're all right.
This all does sound a bit Victorian. I'm surprised you don't get brain fevers.
Well, I don't know. I suppose maybe I do. I don't know. It's just a way of doing it. I can never understand. I think it's probably men who are married who, you know, do 3,000 words in the morning and then go out in the afternoon and have a round of golf. I don't think women do that sort of thing.
My guest is British novelist Beryl Bainbridge. Her new book, Master Georgie, is the third in a trilogy of historical novels set in Victorian times. You were born in Liverpool in 1934. How was your family affected by the Great Depression?
Well, I think long before I was born, I think it wasn't there something I get mixed up. I think it's 1926 or 1929. 1926. My father was kind of an entrepreneurial sort of chap. He was in shipping and property and stuff. And then something about the gold standard went or came or did something peculiar, and he became bankrupt. And in those days, of course, to be a bankrupt was the most appalling scandal and sin and the shame and guilt of it. And so that ruined his life and my mother's life, really, and he was very depressive over it. We didn't really know. The children weren't told. That being said, they still managed to send the two of us. I had a brother to, private schools, and we had music classes and elocution classes and tap dancing and Latin lessons. You know, I mean, they still managed, but it wrecked his life, really.
I think you said somewhere that your parents played the radio. They played civilized talk and fine theater all day so that it would drown out their quarrels?
The first job you did when you came home from school was to turn the radio on, so that the neighbours wouldn't hear the noise. But, yes, I suppose I exaggerate. I mean, one forgets what it was like. To a child, it felt as if it was always like that, you know, but and that's the only reason I wrote books. And in all the early ones, that's what they're all about.
I think you were thrown out of school when you were 14
because
of something you wrote. What was it?
Yeah, well, it wasn't original. I didn't write it. It was the school dirty rhyme that it happened to be my turn to take home. But it wasn't, I didn't compose it. Mind you, I did do the illustrations for it. So I was chucked out.
You left school at 16 to be an actress. How did you start?
No, I was thrown out of school at 13 and a half. I never went to school again. No, I went to a ballet school. I was sent away to a ballet school. I did ballet, which was meant to be a drama school. But I was there for a year and a half, and then I went into repertory, which I think you have repertory in the States, don't you? Repertory companies, theatre companies, yeah.
Why did you give up acting?
I liked doing it. I hated rehearsals. I felt embarrassed because in those days, in those days, certainly in England, we went around, I suppose, a bit influenced by Hollywood. We had to have handbags and hats and proper clothing and stuff. And, you know, nobody had them really. I hated all that. And anyway, I wanted babies. So that's why I gave it up.
So how did you start writing?
Well, I'd always written. I mean, I was from a child, so I'd been married and I had two children, little babies, and my husband disappeared. So it was easy to write because I couldn't afford babysitters, so something to do in the evening. So that's how I, just enjoyed that.
You know, a lot of writers are quite cagey talking about how their writing is drawn from their personal experience, from their past. You say right up front.
A lot of them deny it. A lot of writers deny it. Can't see the point of writing. Why? I mean, everything that happens to one is so much more peculiar than anything you could make up. You've only got to talk to anybody for 5 minutes and the most credible things come out. So why bother, you know, why bother inventing it?
My guest is British novelist Beryl Bainbridge. Her new book, Master Georgie, is the third in a series of historical novels set in Victorian times. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, as were four of her other books. We're going to take a break now, Beryl, and then we're going to talk some more.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is British novelist Beryl Bainbridge. Her new book is Master Georgie. Now, whenever I read about someone I'm going to interview, there's always one piece of information in the materials that is just patently false. So stop me if this is it.
Yeah.
Is it true your mother-in-law once tried to shoot you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She came around with a gun, but she missed. I mean, I used to watch a lot of telly, so... You know, as soon as the gun came out, I knocked her hand upwards, as it were. She brought down the landing ceiling, though.
Now, what was that all about?
She hadn't been taking her pills. She was 71. It wasn't as if she was, you know... she thought I was her. She'd left her children. She came round to punish me, to punish herself for having left her children. So she came round, knocked at the door and said, I want the photographs back of my children, which was her children, not my children. And I could see she was a bit, you know, she was hopping mad. So I went upstairs to get the photographs. And as I came down the stairs, this little old lady was looking into her bag and opening her bag, and out came this, I forget what it was, a Weber pistol or something. It couldn't have killed me. It could have harmed me, but I don't think it could have killed me. But she, and then I went off to work. She ran out, but she stopped a police car and said she tried to shoot some woman. And I'd gone to work in the bottling factory. And then we reenacted the scene on the stairs. And I thought they'd lock her up, but they didn't. And then she came round about 6 months later with a knife. But by then, one was ready for her. Honey, the grandchildren used to hit the floor. You know when Granny looks in her bag for a sweetie? But my children were trained to fall to the floor. But then she threw herself under a train when she was about 75. So it's pretty sad. She was a painter, and quite a good painter, actually. But she ran away. She left her children and ran away to study in Paris under a painter called André Lhotre. And so she was fairly... Gaga.
Have you written about her?
Yes, I put her in a book called The Bottle Factory Outing, but only that bit about her coming around to shoot me, you know, a sort of, well, yeah, I think she's my mother-in-law in that book, yeah.
You worked in this bottle factory in London. Why did you get the job then? This was before you were writing. Or during?
Well, because I was divorced in 1955, I think it was, and the settlement was £7.50, £7.10 a week, forever, as it were. So by the time, and that was 1955, so around about 1965, 75, that wasn't going very far. So I got a job down the road in this bottling factory, only part-time. So that's why I was there. I was only there during school hours. Well, half of school hours.
You made wine bottles?
No, I didn't make wine. I put the labels on the bottles. I just stuck labels. You licked them and stuck the labels on the bottles. It was all the same wine, just different labels.
Allegedly, they let you drink, let the workers drink as much as they wanted
didn't.
To?
No, it was just terrible. No, you weren't. No, it was just... This friend of mine, we On a Saturday morning, we handled spirits, which was most interesting, and we had this thing whereby my friend used to hold one bottle under your arm, hold the other one up, and say, "This is very dirty. I must take it to the ladies' loo to clean it." You see, and then you went rushing through, and then you move the one from under your arm behind the loo, and then you went back with the first bottle, and we only did that about 2 weeks. But I had to leave on, I think it was called compassionate grounds, in that, you know, I'd be there at 10 in the morning. By half past 11, I was paralytic. So it wasn't very good for the health.
From drinking.
That was Saturday. But I got a book out of it. I call the Bottle Factory Outing, which was, we went on a Bottle Factory Outing. And so that's not fiction, it's a fact, you know. We went off to Windsor Park, and there's a death in it. But all the going off and the Italian workmen and all that, that's all true.
You're also a painter. Is your painting method at all like your writing method?
Oh, no, I like painting. I mean, for painting, I have no critical faculty. I think everything I paint is wonderful, so that's great. It's nice. I just enjoy doing that. And you can watch telly while you paint, you see. You can't watch the telly while you're writing. No, they're not. The paintings aren't bad. I used to sell a lot of them. Now I just put them up in the attic for when I'm dead. The children can sort of flog them then, I think, because I don't approve of pensions or anything.
Where are you on your new book about Dr. Johnson?
Nowhere. I've done all the reading. But I'm just trying to think of a way of, again, I'm trying to think of a plot. I mean, I've already been to the newspaper to see the amount of road deaths in those days, in 1740-something, was amazing. But so I suppose it'd be quite gloomy again. But I've just got to think of a way into it, of how to actually do it. You know, that's the devil. You can. I think the more you learn, the more you write, the more perhaps vaguely skillful you get. So then you write a line and you think, that's terrible, I can't use that, that's no good. You know, and you can go on doing that for ages. I think I'll have to go on doing that till I suddenly get panicky. I should have started in July, you see, so. But I'll start next week.
Vera Bainbridge, it was quite enjoyable talking with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Beryl Bainbridge's new novel is Master Georgie. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Travelocity.com. Online reservations with more than 400 airlines, 40,000 hotels, and 50 car rental companies worldwide. www.travelocity.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, designing products that are easy to use, stylish, and popular. We talk with product designer David Kelly. His company, IDEO, designed Apple Computer's first mouse, Kodak's digital camera, and the first portable laptops. And Jeff Nunberg comments on language as a source of national pride and identity. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. We're living in a world where new technology spawns new products on a daily basis, and it's the job of my guest David Kelly to figure out how to make the designs for these products as user-friendly as possible. Kelly is the founder and CEO of IDEO, the largest product design firm in the country. IDEO designs more than 3,000 products a year. Its portfolio includes the first Apple mouse, the Crest stand-up toothpaste dispenser, and Nike's sleek sunglasses. The firm is also responsible for many of the latest internet appliances, like the electronic book. Now clients approach IDEO not only for product design, but also for help in designing a more innovative corporate culture. But for all the products out there that make you say, wow, there are others that make you say, whoa, a lot of the stuff that looks cool, once you get it home, you can't even figure out how to put in the batteries. I asked David Kelly what gives.
I think the people designing the products, most people in the world are kind of sitting around the table thinking they're the experts on the toaster, and so they're the right ones to design the next toaster. So, they're the experts, so they should be able to do it. The problem is that experts use products in different ways than the average person does. And so they, in the old VCRs, it was okay to hold down two buttons and toggle three others in order to set the time and the date. And that's okay for the engineer who designed it because they're an expert. But it's not okay for my grandmother when she starts to try to record her favorite program next week. So the problem comes from the people designing products not having enough empathy for the behavior of actual people.
Let's talk about some of the products you've designed at IDEO that people use every day, or they could. You have a design for an office cubicle that looks like a car. Why don't you describe it for us?
That's the Q product. We call it the Q. Our design for this Office of the Future is like a little cart that has your computer and all your stuff on it. It has a motor in it. And so in the morning you come in, picture you come into a big space, and all these little carts are parked, all these little offices, in effect, are parked. And you jump on the one that you want. You put your identification card in, and all your computer stuff is loaded down, and you put all your little books and stuff on the shelf, so they're already there. And then you drive your office to where you want to be in the building. Let's say, I'd like to be by the windows today, so you drive by the windows. Or you say, I'd like to be over by Sally today, and so you talk to Sally, and you both drive your vehicles to the place you want to be. And so the serious part is it's the easiest way to build teams and break down the offices so that you can be in the right team at the right time.
Sounds great. There's also a bumper car possibility there.
In really creative groups, you'd probably have problems with people crashing into each other on purpose just for fun.
Well, when are we likely to ever see this product on the market or in our office?
I think what you're going to see next, the next step is, right now, companies tend to design their spaces for the individual. And if there's any space left over, then they'll build a conference room out of it. If there's a little space left over, then they can have a place where you can meet. I think what you're seeing more and more, at least in our client base, are people are focusing on the teams, that the problems are complex enough that they really believe that teams and that creative kind of multidisciplinary brainstorming that happens from people being together from different disciplines, kind of the interesting ideas come from the cracks in disciplines instead of right down the center. And so they're starting to design their offices with team space as the center. They focus primarily on building a great space for that team to work. And then after that, they build little spaces to have kind of touchdown spaces for the individual. They also build what we call enclaves, special purpose places with nice chairs if you want to sit and read, or a small office with a couch and two chairs to have a small meeting. And so the end result is you get a team-focused space. And so that then requires the individual spaces to be moved around a lot, depending on how the new teams are formed. And so I think the first step, instead of driving there, the first step will be that they'll be little touchdown spaces all around a team space.
Could you give us an example of a product that's coming out of this intersection of disciplines?
Yes. One of the products that I think is particularly interesting is a new product we've done for a company called HeartStream, which is a portable defibrillator. This is a product that we're trying to make it ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We're hoping that it will be everywhere. What it does is, if you have cardiac arrest, you really only have about 6 minutes before, you know, you have a really serious problem, like you're dead. And that's not long enough for an ambulance to get there. So what this is, you've seen the things on TV where, you know, they put the two paddles on, they say stand back, and they fire it. That's what this is. Only it's a portable unit, but its claim to fame is how easy it is to use, because you're going to have basically a naive user. It's in the back of an airplane. Somebody has a problem. You need to lay them on the floor, and then you have to figure out how to use this thing, which you've never used before. And it looks, you know, at least in the movies, it looks like it's technically difficult to understand. So the part that's multidisciplinary about this is that the people involved to design this are not just the engineers who do the circuitry, or the industrial designers that determine how the thing looks, or the marketing people that figure out how to sell it. There's also people like social scientists and people who understand usability of things, and that's kind of the most important thing in this kind of a product. So you study people and how they use it. Well, that's not a discipline that's normally a part of the mix in product design, or hasn't been in the past. So this product has a kind of a simple 1-2-3 way of using it that allows anybody who would find it or need it when someone was having this kind of cardiac arrest problem, they would be capable of doing it and reviving the person.
Well, you designed the first Microsoft mouse, and in your offices I saw that you have a 6 or 7 foot transparent tube filled with all of the prototypes that it took to make the mouse. There must be hundreds. Now, help me with this. It's a simple idea, right? A box on wheels, basically. What subtleties or intricacies am I missing?
Well, it's not clear, for instance, whether smaller is better. You know, when you use a mouse, sometimes you kind of rest your hand on the table, and you kind of a bar of soap feels like the right size. Sometimes for different tasks, you need to kind of just hold it in the tip of your finger, so a smaller mouse is better. So what we did was we actually made a whole bunch of prototype mice and gave them a maze game, which seemed appropriate for the mouse, which we like gave different shapes and different kind of technologies inside of the mouse, and gave them to people and had them try out, and then measured which was the easiest one they could use to actually do different tasks and that would be normal in using a mouse. One of the funny things is, when we first started doing mice, that we had to test how long they would. You know, how long you measure a mouse in miles to failure. So we take an old record player and put a record on it. We made records out of different types of desk material, you know, like a Formica desk, or a wood desk, or a glass, piece of glass on top of a desk. We'd make records out of that, and we'd put them on the turntable. And then we'd turn them on, and we knew it's 33 1/3. And then we'd tape the mouse to the tone arm of the record player, and then we'd sit it down on the record, and we'd see how long before it had a failure. So miles to failure is how you measure mice.
So how many miles to failure are there in a mouse?
It depends on what kind of material. You know, what happens is that, like, one of the things you have to do is, like, eraser junk off of the desk, you know, the little stray pieces of eraser get, like, inside the mouse and clog it up. And so we had to make the ball removable so you could take it out. People didn't like the sound of a metal ball on the tabletop, and so we had to coat the ball with rubber. And there's, you know, for a simple product, there seemed like there were thousands of little hurdles to get over. There's one thing that people kind of think, people like IDEO, design a product. The truth of the matter is, we're designing the experience of using the product. You see what I mean? It's like the product itself is interesting, and because the engineers love to make the mechanism and design the circuits and all that kind of stuff. But what interests me the most is design the actual experience of using the product. So there's a lot of other things around that. You know, what your chair's like, and what the surface of the table's like, and what's happening on the screen. These are all things that affect your actual experience of using it.
What I imagine is interesting about designing for computers is that you're not only designing for use now, but you're really designing for use in the future. And one of your mantras, I know, for innovation is to live in the future. How do you realize that?
Yeah, that's it's like concepts cars. You know, if you went to the Detroit Auto Show, you'd see these cars that are about the future. You don't really expect to see them in the showrooms next month, but you start to see the direction that the car companies are going. You know, lots of fins or lots of swoopiness or, you know, 27 headlights across the front. Whatever it is, you start to see the direction it's going. And so that's what we try to do. We build these array rooms, we call them, of the future. Whatever, if you're a kitchen appliance manufacturer, we build the future of the kitchen. If you're a company that does surgical equipment, we try to build the operating room of the future. And we get the people, especially the people who are in charge of running the company, the heads of marketing, the presidents, and those kind of people, to walk through the rooms or live in the rooms and try to understand, have a feeling of what it's going to be like in the future. Then once you've painted this what we call scenario of the future, it's easier then as you're collecting information from places to see if that fits in with your direction.
I'm talking with industrial designer David Kelly. He's the founder and CEO of IDEO, which is the largest product design firm in the country. David, we're going to take a break now and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is industrial designer David Kelly. His firm, IDEO, has created award-winning designs for many Fortune 500s. David Kelly also teaches product design at Stanford University. At IDEO, you also teach workshops in innovation to corporations. And one recommendation that you make to companies who want to learn to be more innovative is to have a fun workplace. Now, what do your offices look like?
Our office has been described as more of a zoo than an office. But the important thing is to understand that playfulness is a part of creating. And so, when I walk into a place where the offices look like a long hall with a bunch of closed doors or a sea of cubicles, I realize that it's going to be a hard task to help them with innovation. So our offices are... the most important thing is that they change all the time. Everything seems like an experiment. You know, we build this little team space with old plywood and furniture that we have, and then we learn that we need to improve it some way, and so we'll take it down and redo it. And the other thing that's obvious in a place that's good at innovating is that they tend to have the artifacts of the things that they do are all around, and they're proud of the things they do. So whether it's a magazine that has all of the latest issues torn apart and put up on the wall for you to read, or whether it's a product design firm that has old prototypes laying around, or a products good company that has movies of people using their product. The fruits of their work are kind of all around them because they're proud of that.
Apparently, a group of your young designers have a whole surplus airplane wing in their office.
Yeah. We're dividing what we call studios. There's about 20. We believe that size is very important on being innovative, and so we break the company down into what we call studios of no more than about 20, 25 people. And they get to, of course, do their own offices the way they think's the best way to do it. And so, yeah, so one of them came to me early on and said, you know, we really need a DC-3 wing in our office so that we can do our work. And I said, oh, well, yeah, of course. Sounds like that's what you need. So they took a Winnebago and all piled into it and went down to Los Angeles somewhere, and there's an airplane graveyard, and they came back with the DC-3 wing, and it's like bolted on the wall there.
Whatever it takes to get you through the night, right?
Right.
In teaching innovation, you stress the need to destigmatize failure. What does that mean, to destigmatize failure as part of a corporate culture?
Yeah, well, the thing about being innovative is it's risky, and so you really want to have people have a balance between having the kind of confidence to get their ideas out and also, you know, questioning whether they're good ideas or not. You can't be too sort of arrogant and actually, sort of think your idea is good all the time. On the other hand, you can't be kind of timid enough that you don't really want to get that idea out and have it see the light of day. So if you're always afraid that your idea is going to be rejected by the group or there's some penalty for coming out with it, then then you won't keep the kind of juices flowing and keep coming up with things. There's a Stanford professor in organizational behavior, Bob Sutton, who's a colleague of mine, and he says the best thing to do is to reward success and failure equally and punish inactivity. And I think that's it. If you start to have failure or having a bad idea be punished, then you sort of people start doing less and less and less. And what you really want is people energized and coming up with ideas all the time. And so if the risk is low of coming up with an idea that doesn't work, then you'll come up with more and more ideas. And quantity is a big part of being innovative.
Where do you think then your designers are getting their ideas? And I read somewhere that there's a lot of toys around your offices, and people take things apart and put them back together again, and to be inspired.
Yeah, they certainly get their ideas from the hardware they tear apart. I mean, if you walk through our place, it's an excuse to buy every product that comes on the market. I have to look at the budget on that. But what they do is they just buy everything and tear it apart, because there's kind of no excuse for reinventing something that already exists. So you want to kind of have a library of all the mechanisms and all the products and how everybody did everything. But the ideas are coming more and more from the observation of people using the product. So we have a division of the company called Skyline that designs toys. And the way they do it is they have play day on Thursday, and every Thursday a whole bunch of kids come in and they play with the prototypes that they've done, or they play with existing toys, and we watch them and we see what they particularly like. Like, they particularly like bubbles, or they particularly like things that go fast and crash, or whatever it is they like. Then you start to realize, okay, 3 to 5 year old kids, if that's who we have in the day, really like this. This thing kind of resonates with them. And we start designing a bunch of things that have that kind of characteristics. And then next Thursday, we show them to those kids when they come in. This is not so hard. You just see what works, and then you kind of iterate, and you eventually start to have things that people really fall in love with.
Industrial designer David Kelly is my guest. Were you the kind of kid who took everything apart and couldn't put it back together?
Yeah. In fact, this is a way I do admissions at Stanford. A kid comes in my office, says he wants to declare product design, and I say, tell me about yourself as a child. And if they say the word tinkerer, or if they talk about science projects as their favorite thing, then I know that that's the right kind of person to admit into the program. It's amazing how I'm still amazed. You can take things apart, you put them back together, you don't understand what happened, but when you put them back together, they work. And that's how you learn.
Did you design anything when you were a kid?
Design things all the time. Before there were tandem bikes, I thought I had this great idea where I'd take the bike, the wheel off the back of my friend's bike and weld I take the wheel off the front of my bike and weld the forks to the back of my friend's bike. This is before tandem, so it would be really great. Unfortunately, going around some rough terrain, the weld on the forks broke, and one of us kind of went, tasted a little dirt. But it was fun. It's like you have these ideas. There's a feeling when you work, when somebody, you go to these things and somebody says, what do you really enjoy? The thing I really enjoy is like being in the shop making things. Time kind of stands still for me when I'm actually, in a shop, making something and bolting it together. And that's, if you ask Stanford students who go through the product design program, what do they miss about Stanford the most? They always say the same thing, the machine shop. They want access to a machine shop.
As a CEO, I can't imagine you have a lot of time to get your hands dirty. Is there something you'd really love to be in the machine shop designing right now?
Well, for me, it's now moved more and more towards GIFs. Believe it or not, in this world, it's kind of hard if you're a designer and you kind of are intimate with every product that's on the market around the world. It's a little hard to figure out what to do as gifts, and you end up making things as gifts for people. So most of the time I'm in the shop these days. I mean, I go in the shop to watch what's being done for the company, in that I get invited in all these brainstormers about what's the right thing to do. Now, most of the young designers don't pay much attention to my ideas, but every once in a while, one will sneak in, and so I want to go into the shop and seeing it being made. But with 350 employees, it is kind of hard for me to spend much of the time in the shop. But in my personal life, I've built a little shop at home, and so when it comes time to make a present for a best friend or whatever, instead of going out and buying something, you know, I find myself making it.
Can you tell us what you've made?
I've made all kinds of things, but the things I like to do tend to be like scaled up versions of something. So like a key, you know, I made this kind of key to happiness. Instead of being a little key that was, you know, 2 inches long, I made it, you know, 3 feet long, but perfectly detailed to be exactly like a key, you know, that would be on your key ring. And so it's, people kind of like that feeling of having this kind of odd scaled thing to hang on the wall.
David Kelly, it was a lot of fun talking to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
David Kelly's product design firm, IDEO, is based in Palo Alto.
Here we go.
That's from Orbitone's new CD featuring experimental musical instruments. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on how politics is changing our linguistic map. This is Fresh Air. The political map of the world has changed dramatically in recent years as new nations emerge and old ones break up. And with this has come a revision of the linguistic map as well, as each new nation demands a language of its own. It may seem strange to Americans, but as linguist Jeff Nunberg reminds us, we almost went the same route ourselves once.
Back when the Ebonics controversy was at its height about a year ago, linguists were getting a lot of calls asking them to sort out the question of whether Black English was really a different language from Standard English. To the disappointment of the press, they tended to duck the question. You can't say whether two varieties belong to the same language just by looking at the words or constructions they use. There are cases where people identify distinct languages even when two varieties are grammatically similar and mutually intelligible, like Danish and Norwegian, Czech and Slovak, or Dutch and Afrikaans. And there are other cases where people perceive a single language even though its varieties are very far apart. The various dialects of Chinese, for example, are far more different from one another than French, Italian, and Spanish. In the end, languages are political constructions. As linguists like to put the point, a language is just a dialect with an army. There's a lot to this remark. In recent years, a number of nations have felt that a declaration of political independence required a declaration of linguistic independence as well. Until a few years ago, for example, the central part of the region formerly known as Yugoslavia was filled with a jumble of very similar dialects that were considered a single language, Serbo-Croatian. Apart from some differences in scholarly and philosophical vocabulary, the main thing that set the Serbs and Croats apart was that the Croats used the Latin alphabet and the Serbs often used the Cyrillic alphabet. It was only when the country of Yugoslavia broke up that the separate nations felt the need to distinguish three languages, Serbian, Croatian, and Bosnian. As one Sarajevo professor described the situation, I used to think I was bad at languages, but I woke up one morning to find I was trilingual. At present, the three languages are a lot closer than the English of New York, London, and Melbourne. But the Serbs and Croats are doing all they can to change that. They've each got their academies working nights to devise distinctive vocabulary and new spellings, apparently with the ultimate aim of achieving complete incomprehensibility with their neighbors. It may all seem a little alien to us, but we should bear in mind that we Americans went through a very similar experience 200 years ago. In the period following the American Revolution, there were a lot of people who believed the American language would naturally go its separate way from English once it was free from what they like to describe as the feudal establishments of England. As the patriot William Thornton told Americans in 1793, "You have corrected the dangerous doctrines of European powers. Correct now the languages you have imported. The American language will thus be as distinct as the government." The idea of declaring American a separate language was enormously popular at the time. Its supporters included Adams, Jefferson, and most notably the great lexicographer Noah Webster. To distinguish the American language symbolically from its English ancestor, Webster devised a number of new spellings. He dropped the U in words like honor and favor, flipped the R and the E of theater and meter, changed the C in defense to an S, and so forth. Most of these are still with us, of course, a little token of national linguistic pride, though NASA seems to have lost track of this point when they spelled the name of the space shuttle Endeavour with a U. In the end, though, those spelling differences are the only legacy of the episode. The idea of declaring American a separate language took a while to die out, particularly among American writers who wanted to liberate our literature from what they regarded as an obsequious deference to British models. As Walt Whitman proclaimed, "The new world, the new times, the new peoples need a tongue according." But by the middle of the 19th century, most Americans were willing to concede that they still spoke the same language that the English did. And the English more or less returned the favor. Still, you have to wonder what would have happened if Webster's view had won the day and America and Britain had gone on to develop mutually incomprehensible languages, the way the former Yugoslavians are doing now. Probably it would have been our loss in the end. After all, Alistair Cook is a small price to pay for Absolutely Fabulous and Emma Peel.
Jeff Numberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Hurdick, Fred Snyder, and Al Banks. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Mannheim Steamroller, whose new release, The Christmas Age, is available in music stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.